Good morning, ladies and ladies. I wanted to, I'm off during the summer, so I could give classes during the mornings. Usually I'm teaching during the mornings, but at least during August I'm here, so nice to be able to do a shiur in the mornings. I wanted to speak about mezuzah, specifically mezuzah as far as, is it a shmira for our mind, a shmira for our body? And I'd like to do something a little bit different, is to go through some of the halachos of mezuzah, and show how a lot of them are based on, we know that, we've always assumed that mezuzah is there to protect in a certain sense, but to show how a lot of the halachas of mezuzah also reflect the fact that mezuzah is there to protect us. We'll see how it comes out. I'll try to weave together a little bit of halacha with a little bit of hashkafa. And it happens to be that this week between Eschanan and Ekev is the perfect week to talk about mezuzah. Why? Because last week's parasha was the first chapter of Kriyas Shema, where the mitzvah of mezuzah was chsavtam al mezuzas beisachav v'yisharecha, and this coming parasha has a second parasha of Ekev has a second parasha of Kriyas Shema v'haya, where it also says chsavtam al mezuzas beisachav v'yisharecha at the end of the second parasha of Kriyas Shema. So right now, today is the middle of these 2 weeks, so it's the perfect time to talk. We're sandwiched between both mentions of mezuzah in the Torah. So this is the perfect time. I want to begin with a Rambam. The Rambam says something very unusual, and maybe we'll try to understand it. Rambam says, a person has to be very careful with the mitzvah. Every person has to be careful with the mitzvah of mezuzah, which is a mitzvah on everybody, of course, men and women alike. And it's a mitzvah that applies all the time, right? It's not just, it's not a seasonal mitzvah. This is what the Rambam says. Every time a person enters, I'm just paraphrasing the Hebrew, every time a person enters and exits a room, he meets Yichud Shmo Shehakadosh Baruch Hu. He meets HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He meets HaKadosh Baruch Hu's unity, meaning because we talk about Hashem Echad in the mezuzah. And when a person, again, crosses over the threshold of the door and bumps into, as if it were HaKadosh Baruch Hu, listen to what the Rambam says. Yizkar ahavaso. A person should think about the fact that he loves Hashem. This is a mitzvah to love Hashem. And then he should awaken from his slumber. Where else do we find that language? Awaken from the slumber. A certain mitzvah. What? That's about me waking up from a slumber. Here he's not talking about physical slumber. He's saying that when I bump into Hashem as I pass the mezuzah, we should awaken from our slumber. There's one other mitzvah that the Rambam says also, that the point of that mitzvah is to awake us from our spiritual slumber, the mitzvah of shofar. The same language that it says by the Rambam says, the whole idea of shofar is like a wake-up call, like an alarm clock, says the Rambam here also, that when we bump into it, which is incredible, if you think of shofar is that, you know, once a year, it's you go to shul, it's an incredible thing, everyone's standing there, and the rabbi's up there in the kittel, and here the Rambam is saying, every single time that we pass by a mezuzah, we bump into HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that should serve as a wake-up call to think of, okay, this is a fascinating thing. And then he says something else. He says, anybody who has a man who's wearing his tefillin, in the olden days they used to wear their tefillin all day long. Nowadays we just wear it for davening, not even mincha or ma'ariv, just for shachris. So a person would be wearing their tefillin on their arms and their heads and tzitzis on their clothing, and it has the mezuzah in their doorway. Says the Gemara, such a person will certainly not be chote, because the person has so many reminders. So I guess women don't need all the reminders. Men need all the reminders. So there are all these reminders, but listen to what he says. These are the malachim, these are the angels who save a person from sin. In other words, what the Rambam is saying is that when we talk about, you know, we say Shalom Aleichem on Friday night, we're greeting the angels that walk with, that accompany a person home from shul, Shalom Aleichem, and then we say when they leave, Tseischem L'Shalom, we're greeting the angels that accompany a person. What are those angels? Says the Rambam, they're not these, you know, six-winged creatures flying up and down, you know, hovering over us like drones. The mitzvahs that we surround ourselves with, those are the things that protect us. That's what protect us from what's around us. So, I mean, it might fit a little bit with the Rambam's general idea of the Rambam being somebody who is not into a lot of the superstitious kind of phenomena, But the Rambam says these mitzvahs that surround a person, that we surround ourselves with, for example, mezuzah, these are the malachim that save us from being chote, which is just a fascinating idea, that the mitzvahs that we do are themselves those. What does it mean that it saves us from being chote? How does a mitzvah save us from being chote? Well, if you're involved, if your person is pursuing, that pursues mitzvahs, a person tries to surround, if we try to surround ourselves with mitzvahs, it's going to be very hard to involve ourselves and indulge in doing averos if we're always either pursuing mitzvahs or surrounding ourselves or reminding ourselves of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So it's just going to be harder to do averos if we're surrounded by mitzvahs. At least in a spiritual sense, we have these malachim, again, the mitzvahs that protect us, at least spiritually, from doing averos. Okay, now, if I ask you a question, let's go mention one or two of the halachos of mezuzah that might illustrate this point. What rooms require a mezuzah? Storage rooms, garages, gates to cities. What about if you have a stable with horses or cows, a corral? Do those need mezuzahs? Wine cellar? So the Gemara tells us, well, we say in the pasuk, "Chasavta al mezuzas beisecha uvisha'arecha." What are the parameters of beisecha? What are the parameters of bisha'arecha? Gemara Yoma says, whether it's the shahr of a house or the shahr of a courtyard or the shahr of a city or the shahr of a state, I'm not sure what it's states with gates, maybe it's like toll plazas, and a refes. What's a refes? A refet? Yeah, like a corral or a dairy, like a, yeah. Lulin are chicken coops. Matbe, in a place where you store tevin, that's like a silo, a grain silo. Place where you store wine, a wine cellar. All of these are chayav mezuzahs.
What about when you keep the garbage, you know, on the side of the house and there's a
no, that doesn't need. Because that's not a place of kavod. The same way a bathroom wouldn't. So it's a place that's dirtiness or it smells that wouldn't need. So the Rambam, the Gemara says, basically any place that is part of your living space, base dira. Dira we know in modern Hebrew is a dira. When I was in the Mir, we lived in a dira, properly enunciated as dira. Dira is a place where you live. So any place where you live, but not just a place where you live in terms of your living room, dining room, bedroom, a place where you live where you're living experience is experience. If you have a storage room or a garage, those all are required to have a mezuzah. What place does not require to have a mezuzah? You mentioned things like bathrooms. Exactly. Mikvah I have to think about. That's something to think about. That's a bathhouse. That's because it's like a bathroom. That could be, it's like a... Shuls don't need this. They might have, some shuls do have. We'll see a little story why some shuls might have, but shuls do not need. The Gemara says explicitly, right after it says all these things that you never thought of. You never thought that the wine cellar. How often do you go into the wines? You never thought that the silo to store the grain that needs a mezuzah. And right after that, it says, but maybe also. Well, it talks about the Beis Hamikdash. Maybe also the gates to Har Habayis, and maybe also the entrances to the Beis Hamikdash. Right, that's in the news. The entrances to Har Habayis, well, all those doorways where our cousins are, playing soccer and walking in and out of, that we don't walk in those. All those doorways, on time of the Beis Hamikdash, did those doorways, do they need a mezuzah? Says the Gemara, no. Only a bayis, what does the pasuk say? Chasavta ba mezuzos beisa? Cha. Yours, just your person's house, and not HaKadosh Baruch Hu's house of the Beis HaMikdash. And from that we extrapolate, so too, a Beis Knesses, also a shul will not need a mezuzah. So the question is, what's the logic here? What's the logic? Why is it? I mean, yes, we learned from the Pasuk. The Pasuk tells us, Hashem says, write it on the houses of Beis Echa, your house. So from that we could deduce, okay, and not Hashem's house. But that's just a technical, proof where we see in the Pasuk that Hashem's house or the Beis HaMikdash or a shul is disqualified or set outside the parameters. But why should that be? I'm assuming that if we assume the point of, on some level, of the mezuzah to provide us a shmirah, so any place where we live or our lifestyle takes us is a place that needs a shmirah. But whose house? Who Ke'ilu is living in the Beis HaMikdash, as if it were? Whose house is the shul? The shul's not my house, it's not your house, it's HaKadosh Baruch Hu's house. He don't need no shmirah. So therefore, it follows a little bit that the fact that the point of a mezuzah is to provide shmirah on us, so those places that are his domain, as if it were, ought not require that shmirah. But I want to tell you a story. You'll notice that a number of shuls and bate medrash do have mezuzahs. In fact, they sell it for a lot of money, right? When you have a capital campaign, you could then you want to name the building, that'll be $100,000. Name the base medrash, that'll be $50,000. If you don't have $50,000 to spare, you could dedicate a mezuzah to the shul for $1,800. Mezuzah to the shul? There's no obligation to have a mezuzah. There's a bigger mitzvah to put a shul, a mezuzah on the social hall in the basement than on the entrance to the shul itself, halachically. But that's now the executive director's thing. So I want to tell you a story. This story is recorded, good morning. This story is recorded in the tour. One of the Rishonim was the Marami Rotenberg. Marami Rotenberg was famous because he was actually captured, he was taken captive by Emperor Ferdinand. I think that was his name. Emperor Ferdinand in the 1200s, a long, long time ago. And when he was taken captive, there was a ransom that was placed on his head to the Jewish community for an exorbitant amount of money, because he was the leader of the Jewish community, and he refused to allow himself to be redeemed because he was concerned that if he allows himself to be redeemed for this exorbitant amount of money, what the Jewish community would have raised, then it would just set precedent. I mean, that's really the idea of non-negotiation with terrorists. That's the whole idea where the non-negotiation policy comes from. If you give in to a terrorist once, they'll just, hey, terrorism works, let's do it again. So that was the Rusei Marami Rotenberg. He was a great person, obviously. He was a Rebbe of the Rush. The Rush was the father of the Tur, who is the predecessor for the Shulchan Aruch. So we're talking about the 12, 1300s. And the Tur, again, so I told you that the Marami Rotenberg, who was taken captive, he was a Rebbe of the Rush. The Rush, who was his student, ran away. Right after his Rebbe was taken captive, the Rush himself, Rabbeinu Asher, realized he was next in line, so he also ran away. He became, I think he was originally Ashkenazi, and right at that point in history, he ran away to Spain. He sort of, he converted to Sephardi. It was right at that point when his Rebbe was taken captive, he realized he was next on line to be the gadol of the Jewish, of the Torah world, and he fled. And his son was the Tur. So the Tur quotes his father's Rebbe, the Marami Rotenberg, that he had a base medrash, and he didn't have a mezuzah on it, as the halacha would have it. And then listen to this. The Tur records, again, his father, the Rush's Rebbe, the Marami Rotenberg, decided at one point to, yes, put a mezuzah on his base medrash. Why? One time he was taking a nap in the afternoon, the Marami Rotenberg. So Marami Rotenberg was taking a nap in the afternoon, and a ruach ra'a was, some bad, evil spirit was bugging him, was frightening him. And that somehow pushed him to put up a mezuzah on the base medrash door. And after that, this ruach ra'a, whatever that might mean, stopped. What's unusual about that is the Tur, which I told you is the predecessor for the Shulchan Aruch, tells you halachas. He doesn't tell you Bava Mitzvos, he doesn't tell you stories. This story, he does record, which is fascinating. This story is recorded in halacha that the Marami Rotenberg, the great Marami Rotenberg, felt that even though it's not absolutely necessary, it's not halachically obligatory to put a mezuzah on a shul, but since this story, that has become the minhag. So when you look at shuls, you'll often find that shuls do sometimes have mezuzahs, certainly bate medrash, which is a little more complicated, because in the olden days, base medrash, there used to be two things in every city. There'd be a base medrash for people to learn, and a shul where people would daven. They weren't the same. They were two different things. Nowadays, it's sort of, a lot of times, becomes enmeshed in one. But in the olden days, people used to sleep in the base medrash. And people used to eat in the Beis Medrash, not the Shul, but the Beis Medrash. So therefore, there became a halachic difference, because we said that the definition of where a mezuzah is necessary is only a place that is for our living space, our dira. So Beis Medrash, even though people need to learn, it's a place to learn, but that ended up being a place where people also would sleep a little bit, and people would also eat a little bit as they're learning. They drink a coffee, or whatever. Nobody drinks a coffee while they're davening. But when people learn, they drink a coffee, they have some cookies. So therefore, it developed a split that a mezuzah would be put up in a Beis Medrash, but not in a shul. Since this story started, people started putting up mezuzahs in shul. Not because it's halakhically obligatory, but that's what's this story invited people. People get sometimes are more scared of stories than of halacha. So, okay. We mentioned that the Beis HaMikdash didn't have a mezuzah because it's Hashem's house. There was one area where it did. There was one area in the Beis HaMikdash where somebody did live. Where was that? Or who was that? When was that? What? Which one? The Kohen Gadol. When? On Yom Kippur. The week before Yom Kippur, the Kohen Gadol would have to stay in the Beis HaMikdash for a week. He would live there. The Rambam writes that a mezuzah was needed only for the chambers, that chamber, and the chambers that enter that chamber, that lead to the chamber where the Kohen Gadol slept, and only that week of the year. Fascinating. The rest of the year, there was no mezuzah. But the week, a week before Yom Kippur, you know, in some Gedalia, they would have to install a mezuzah only on those entrances that led to that chamber where the Kohen Gadol slept.
But did they take it off afterwards?
I understand what your question is. That you're asking a very good question. That's a good question. It doesn't say explicitly. We'll get to your question a little bit at the end of the class, at the end of this year, hopefully. But I understand where you're asking. But I have a more, you know, besides that question, I have another question. What about, wasn't there, who else was in the Beis HaMikdash? What else were people doing in the Beis HaMikdash? They were having barbecues every day. Right. Beis HaMikdash, they eat in karbanos, right. And they ate, they washed and said, also there were karbanos menachos, karban todos have loads of bread. So you have the Kohanim eating lots of food, lots of meat, lots of bread. So why didn't that... Isn't that the Kohanim living? I mean, again, they're not sleeping there, but it's not just a matter of sleeping, it's a matter of you living. They're living in Kohanim, they're there. Kohanim come to Yerushalayim, they had shifts of 1 week at a time, twice a year. Except for Yom Tov, when all the Kohanim worked, each Kohen, his family worked 1 week a year, and then 6 months later, another week a year. So if they ate in the Beis HaMikdash, how come that didn't need a mezuzah for the whole year while all the Kohanim are eating throughout? I want to share with you a beautiful idea that the Aruch HaShulchan says. The Aruch HaShulchan says, why were they eating? They're eating for? Not themselves. They're eating for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And therefore, we said that a living space needs mezuzah. But whose living space is that? If they're eating for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, for the mitzvah of eating the karbanah, yes, they're eating, they're enjoying it. But they're eating for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. They're eating their bread, their meat for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Even if they end up falling asleep, why are they falling asleep that week that they're there? So they could have energy too. They could have energy to do whatever else they need to do the rest of the day, the rest of the week. And therefore, which is a beautiful idea, that if a person is eating or sleeping or doing whatever they need to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that's actually considered Hashem's living, not their own living, which is a beautiful, I think, a beautiful idea, something to think about in our own lives, that when we do things not just for our own, just because we want it, but we want to do it, we're eating and sleeping anyway, but if we just direct our minds that I'm having lunch, I'm having breakfast, but I'm going to have in mind that I'm having my lunch and my breakfast so that I could do mitzvah, so that I could daven, so that just elevates, it transforms, it sublimates the same act, that same 8 hours that I'm sleeping, halavai, the same, you know, breakfast, lunch, and supper that I'm eating. It sublimates it, it elevates it to become a living for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, not just something for our own bellies. It's a beautiful idea to consider. Okay, now let me ask you a question. Obviously, a non-Jew does not have to put up a mezuzah. And let's say I own a building. Let's say I own an apartment building. So who has to put up a mezuzah? we'll start with this. Who has to put up the mezuzah? The owner or the renter? The tenant or the landlord? So that's the question. Does the one who lives there or the one who owns it? That's the question. And what would be a rationale for one or the other? So the Gemara says the following. The Gemara asks this question. The Gemara says, the mitzvah of mezuzah, who's the mitzvah on? Is it on the landlord or is it on the tenant? The Gemara says, well, if the point of the mezuzah is to provide shmirah, who's the one who needs the shmirah? The tenant, the one who lives there. And therefore, the Gemara concludes the obligation is on the tenant. The tenant, yeah? I hear, but I guess that's a different level of shmirah than... I hear that. But that's protecting his wealth, not protecting him. But I hear what you're saying. Right. He wants his assets protected, but it's not a self-protection. It's protection of his assets, which is a little bit more removed from himself.
Somebody sells the house to a Jew. He's not allowed to take the...
That is correct. Do you know why? There are a number of reasons. One of the reasons why is because of what we're discussing also, because if a person would take off the mezuzahs when they know another Jew is coming in, you're removing that shmirah, that protection that will be provided to the newcomer. You have no right to remove that protection from that person coming in. I actually get a lot of shyness about this. When people move and when they can't take the mezuzahs, a lot of people don't realize. And sometimes there's a lot of money at stake. If you think of how many doorways there are in a house, there could be 20 doorways in a house. If you have 25 doorways in a house, and if you assume that there are cheaper mezuzahs, there are more expensive mezuzahs. If a person has nice mezuzahs, which could be $100 a piece, you're talking about $2,500. These are the kinds of things that lawyers might have to include in the contracts of sale of houses. Something to not to take lightly. I got a shayla from somebody in the shul. Somebody's son in the shul was moving, and asked me, I have, $2,000 or $3,000 worth of mezuzahs, can I take them with me? And I said, forget about the halachos of can you take them with you or not. Are you allowed to remove a mezuzah if a Jew moves into your house, but you sold your house? Anything that's attached to your house that wasn't excluded in the contract of sale is part of the house, so you sold it. It's not just that you're not allowed to remove the mezuzahs because it's not right to remove a mezuzah if a Jew's moving in. It's more than that. In the same way that chandelier was sold with the house because it's attached, it's a fixture in the house, in the same way that if you left an oven, for example, I don't know if oven's attached, whatever it is, and that's included in the contract of sale, well, even if it was, unless you specified otherwise, which they didn't, because he asked me a day too late, I think the day he was moving he asked me, it's attached to the house, and therefore it's part of the contract of sale. It's part of the house, and therefore, not just from a religious perspective, from a hilchos mezuzah that you can't take the mezuzah if another Jew is moving in. From a legal perspective, from a monetary perspective, from a choshen mishpat, halachic perspective of finances, you wouldn't be able to take it because you sold the mezuzahs as part of your house. Yeah. That could be an option. That is correct. They were $40 mezuzahs, not $140 mezuzahs. Yes, that could be fine. If you switch it to cheaper mezuzahs, that might be okay. There are these questions we could, they're often halacha lemais, they're very halacha lemais, that it gets a lot of money at stake. Each one has its own twist. But yeah, that would be an option. Some other people say if it's an apartment that's going to be painted between tenants, if you're moving out of your apartment, I lived in Washington Heights, and when anybody would move out of an apartment, the landlord would paint the apartment. So you assume that when it's going to be painted, the non-Jewish painters are going to take down the mezuzahs. That also, Rav Henkin said that that's permitted, you're allowed to take down the mezuzahs because they're going to be taken down anyway by a guy who knows what's going to happen to them. That was also, you take them down, you move out, and that's also another scenario where it would be okay to take down the mezuzahs. But more often than not, the halacha is you have to leave them. Yeah. If there's a good chance, depends where you live, but like if you live in a place where there's a good chance a non-Jew will move in, then that's correct. You could take it with you. If you know definitely, either because you know the tenant or you know it's a building where only Jews are moving in, if you have an apartment building in the middle of Borough Park and the only place people are going to pay rent that's so high because in the middle of Borough Park are Jews, then you wouldn't be able to take it with you. Okay, let's. So then you would take it. Well, if you're renting it, so you know who you're renting it. You're going to know who you're renting it to. So if a guy move in, then you would take it down. Oh, you're saying you're moving out. I have to think about that. You say you move out, and you want to take the mezuzah with you, and you're going to find a renter a week later after you move out. So should you leave the mezuzah and find out who you're renting it to?
It's in the broker's hand.
Oh, if you're selling or renting?
Oh, renting.
So we have to speak about the details, you know. Depends on the case. Okay. So what about a maid's room? You have a house, and there's a basement, a room in the basement, a room in the west wing where a non-Jew lives. So does that room in the house need a mezuzah? On one hand, it's your house. On the other hand, the one who's living there is a non-Jewish person who doesn't need a mezuzah there. That's true. They could be saying they could be eating treif or whatever it is. Okay, that could be. So the Aruch HaShulchan says something interesting. He says something that's very subtle. We said before that your wine cellar needs a mezuzah. Why? You're not sleeping in your wine cellar. It's because a room that's part of your living style, your lifestyle, is considered your living space, even though you don't actually spend so much time there living there. Says Aruch HaShulchan, if it's a Gentile person who's working in your house, that's part of your living space. Part of your lifestyle is that this lady or this person is living in the house to help with whatever they're going to help with cleaning and the cooking. And therefore, it's part of your living space to have this person live in your house. So when Christina something or other has her apartment in your basement, it's so that it's part of your living space. Not like you're renting it to her and she just happens to be, you know, subletting your basement. Okay, then she's the tenant, she has to do whatever she wants. She doesn't have to put up a mezuzah. But if it's your house and she's living there so that you could have somebody available to watch your kids when you go to work at 7:30 in the morning, or to, you know, do the whatever other chores need to be done. So it's your living space. She's lit. It's your living space for her to live there, and therefore that would require a mezuzah even on a maid's door. Okay. Excellent question. An office is a little bit complicated. Chances are, because, you know, we have, it's hard because the concept of an office, or even, let's talk about a store, that's what's talking about, a chanus. The Shulchan Aruch talks about a chanus. I wonder if our chanuyot are similar to the Shulchan Aruch's idea of what a chanus was. Meaning, nowadays our stores are open, could be 10 hours a day, even 12 hours a day, right? Open at 10 a.m. till 7 p.m., 10 hours a day. In the olden days, I wonder if they had a chanus, and there were market hours, you know, from probably 4 hours a day, 5 hours a day. So at least in the Shulchan Aruch, it says that a chanus is not obligated in a mezuzah. That's not, you're not living there. You're spending time there, but that's not called living. It could be that the offices that we live in nowadays, some people spend more time in the office than they spend in their own homes. Certainly waking hours for sure, but even some people, depending on profession, you spend, you know, 12, 13 hours a day in the office, and then 12 hours in the office, 2 hours commuting, and then they're home for a total of 10 out of 24 hours. So, Meikar Hadin, an office probably does not require. It is proper because we do spend so many hours there that it should. So, if, for example, somebody was in a position that it would be very awkward or uncomfortable for them to put up a mezuzah in their office, there might be room to be lenient. But if a person has the ability, then it would probably be proper too. But maybe I wouldn't make a bracha on it. Yeah. That's probably that is a real question. I had a Rebbe in Eretz Yisrael who had elderly parents living. I don't remember if it was in his house or in a nearby apartment, and they had a Filipino, which, like in Eretz Yisrael, a lot of Filipinos are very good at elder care. And the Filipinos, you know, some, I don't know what religion they were doing, but they had a real idol. A real idol. They took out, and they did their thing, and they put it away, and living in his parents' apartment. And that's a very, you know, this person's been with his mother, his father for 5 years, and takes wonderful care of them. The halacha is you're not allowed to have a avodah zara. You own the house. It's your house. It's your house. If you own it, or even if you're renting it, it's your house. You can't have a avodah zara in your house. That was a very tough question. I think it was a problem. I think they told the person that they can't have their idol there. I don't think it would be any different. That's a tough question. Yeah. So if somebody's in a rehab center, let's say somebody broke their hip and they need to be in a rehab center in a non-Jewish rehab center for 40 days, right? For more than 30 days. I've never heard people putting up, we have to ask the nursing home people, what people ask. Oh, but that's because it's a Jewish nursing home. What if it's a non-Jewish nursing home and a person finds himself, and they know that they're going to be there. They know the rehab for the broken hip is going to be whatever it is, it's going to be for, you know, 32-day rehab. I don't know the answer. I mean, partially, usually the rehab center could reassign you to a different room whenever they want. So it's your room, it's your rental. No, it's not. They're going to take care of you. They'll give you what you need. It could be, you know, this room. It could be if they feel that for whatever reason they have to switch you. You know, that might get into more technical nursing home policies, and I don't know the answer. I have to. Right. That could be. Don't know. No, that's meaningless. That's meaningless. Having a mezuzah hanging around your neck or hanging from the, you know, the cabbies in Eretz Yisrael, the, you know, those cabbies that we love schmoozing with in Eretz Yisrael, the hanging mezuzah down from the rear view mirror, meaningless. Absolutely meaningless. Absolutely. I get it. Is there some... No, yes, meaningless. Okay, I have a friend who, his parents for many years wanted to live in the Old City. They made Aliyah and they got themselves an apartment in the Old City. And they had to redo it a little because there were a bunch of kids, and they had to redo the apartment, and they found that they couldn't just drill through the walls because it was a medieval, the buildings in the Old City, some of them are from medieval times. The walls were 6 feet thick. 6 feet thick. Literally 6 feet thick. Some of the walls. So they encountered much greater expenses than they anticipated when they had to renovate that apartment. Now, let's say you have a thick wall. Let's say it's not thick, a thick doorway. You walk through the doorway, but through one of these rooms where the doorway itself could be, the depth of the doorway could be 6 feet. Okay, let's not talk about 6 feet. Let's say it's 1 foot, deep. Where is the mezuzah supposed to be situated? Should it be situated on the outermost, such that when you come in, right, when you walk, let's say this is the doorway, these are the thickness of the entranceway. Should I put the mezuzahs on, right, as I bump into the entranceway, or should I put the mezuzah closest to the interior of the room? What would be the proper place to put it on mezuzah? In our walls, which are usually about 3 or 4 inches thick, some walls, certainly the older walls, which are, let's say, 4 or 5 inches, you have the same question. You could put it, you know, on the front edge or 2 inches more recessed to the interior. So where would be the proper place to put the mezuzah? Right when you bump into it on the outside, or more close to the interior? So the Gemara in Menachos asks this question, and this is Machlokas. Both say you should put it on the outside. The outside, I mean, inside the entranceway, but on the first part of the entranceway, not on the interior part of the depth of the wall. Why? One opinion says, because to bump into it more quickly. You want to bump into the mezuzah. When you come in, you bump into it first. The other opinion says, no, it's because the mezuzah is shomer whatever is inside of it. So, of course, the mezuzah is going to be shomer the room, but wait, what about that foot of space when you enter the room? Don't you want to put the shmira as far out as you can, such that there's more interiors, there's more space to be included within the shmira, and therefore, the Gemara rules to put it on the outside so that you have more area within to be shomer. So you see a fascinating case in this scenario where you have the concept, the philosophy of mezuzah being something that provides a shmirah, manifesting itself in halakha of where to put the mezuzah so that it maximizes the shmirah of the room that you're putting in. Yeah. Do you have a question? Okay. To the outside. To the outside. So that you have more space inside as being protected. There's more area within the protection, the shmirah, of the mezuzah. Okay. There's a beautiful Rabbeinu Bechayi. We know that on the outside of the mezuzah, on one side of the klaf, you have the parashiyas of mezuzah. On the outside of the klaf, if you ever look, there's the name of Hashem, Shin with Dalet and a Yud. The name of Shakai. And the Rabbeinu Bechayi, in his commentary on the Chumash, where in the parasha of mezuzah, says something very interesting. He says, the word mezuzah, the gematria, I'm not so into gematrias, but if it's a gematria, it's mentioned by a Rishon, you know, already 800 years ago, I take that a little more seriously. What's the gematria of the word mezuzah? Mem is 40, two zions is 14, so that's 54, the u is 6, that's 60, and the hey at the end is 65. Says Rabbeinu Bechayi, the gematria of the word mezuzah is the same gematria as Ado with a nai, the name of Hashem of Adonis. Aleph is 1, Dalet is 4, that's 5. Nun is 50, that's 55. And the Yud at the end is 65. Rabbeinu Bechayi says that word mezuzah is the same gematria as Ado, as Hashem. To say, as if to tell you that Hashem, I don't want to say incarnate, but Hashem kivyachol is, he's standing there, the mezuzah is Hashem's presence standing there to protect us when we go in and when we go out. And he continues to say, what about that name, Shin with Dalet and Yod, that we write on the outside of the mezuzah? He says something interesting. What is the word, that root, the root of the word Shin, Dalet, mean? It could be for the word Dai. Dai is enough. Enough that Hashem provides us, that Shol, whatever we have is enough. That's one possibility. But the Rebbeinu Bechayi says something different. He says that the word is to be shodeid, is to conquer, to overcome. And he says that as a person enters their house, people might have the wrong, people of the world might have the wrong perspective, says Rabbeinu Bechayi, that why does, you know, how does a person have hatzlacha? So, they have hatzlacha because of their fate, because of their astrology. Again, he's talking to people 800 years ago. People have hatzlacha because of whatever their stars say, the constellation says that they're going to have hatzlacha. So, or you could talk in, you know, more contemporary terms, because they're going to have, they have these gifts or those things. So as a person should realize, the word shakai on the outside of the mezuzah says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is shodeid. He overwhelms, he conquers all the other forces. So all the hatzlacha that comes into a house is not because of whatever other powers that a person might think. It's Hashem who is overcoming all the ma'arachos, all the systems that might be running, whether the systems of the astrological systems or the systems of, you know, cause and effect. Everything is all the hatzlacha that comes into a house comes from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And then he quotes a beautiful story. A story that's quoted from the Yerushalmi, where one of the, I don't know if it was a king, a Caesar, Rabbeinu Yehuda HaNasi, lived at the end of the period of the Mishnayos, and he was very wealthy. He was very wealthy, and he used his wealth, of course, to compile the Mishnayos. And this is in the year around 250. And he was the greatest person in the Torah in the Jewish community. He was also the wealthiest Jew. He had sort of everything, the guy that has everything. He got a gift from one of the, the Roman Caesars or somebody, a beautiful pearl with an instruction letter attached. The instruction letter said, this is for you. I would like you to send me something of either greater value or of equal value. So, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi sends him back a mezuzah. The courier delivers the mezuzah to this, whether it's a Caesar or some other nobleman, who's infuriated and says, I sent you this precious pearl that doesn't have any, you know, a perfect, I don't know, with diamonds there's cut, clarity, and carat. I don't know what the parameters are to determine good pearls. I sent you a perfect pearl that's valued, it's an incredible value, and you're sending me something that's, you know, a scrap, you know, a piece of leather with some writing on it. And Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi says, my gift is greater than your gift. Why? Because your gift has a set value, whatever it is, as high as it is, it's a set value. But the gift that I sent you, there's no end to its value. Why? No, not only that, he says, but if you have a pearl, who has to protect the pearl? You have to make sure you don't lose it. You have to make sure it doesn't get stolen. So you have to protect your pearl. What I sent you will protect you. It's a beautiful idea of the shmira that a mezuzah provides. Remind me of a story in about a hundred. That's a very good question. That's a fabulous question. I think they bring a proof from this story. Yes, this story is recorded in a discussion that the post can have separately about are you allowed to give a gift to a guy of a mezuzah or not. This Yushalmi, this story is brought as a proof that it might be okay. Others say you can't. That's a good point. A very good point. You shouldn't be able to give. In general, we don't want to give anything that has divrei kedusha to a guy because they could defame it. I don't know. I have a good answer for that question. Yeah, but this is one of the sources that might indicate that maybe it would be okay. So this kind of conversation reminded me of a story that happened in the Chavetz Chaim. Apparently, was involved at one of the cities where he lived, around where he lived. They wanted to build a hospital, and I guess some of the Chavetz Chaim students were sort of in the back, and there are the wealthy city people, you know, sitting around the table saying, okay, I'll donate 3 beds, I'll donate 5 beds to build this hospital for the Jewish community. And one of the, you know, wealthy people in the town decided to poke fun at some of the yeshiva guys standing in the back who are watching, you know, this Chavetz Chaim running this meeting. And he says, okay, I'll give as many beds as that, you know, that fellow in the corner, that yeshiva guy in the corner. Chavetz Chaim pounds on the table and says, you couldn't afford it if you tried. So the wealthy person got terrified, like, oh, is there some, he's a really a millionaire, I didn't know about it, or something. So the Chavetz Chaim said that when you build your beds, you could only heal people who are sick. That person in the corner who's learning Torah, he's protecting people from getting sick in the first place with all your money. That can't do that. Just to remind me of the similar kind of conversation that Rebbe had with this Roman nobleman. I just want to finish off with two more ideas. One is, what's the source for when we walk by putting your hands on the mezuzah, kissing it, or not kissing it, but at least putting your hand on the mezuzah? So let's back up. There's a question that was asked, or Rabbi Akiva Eger, who lived about 200 years ago, he was bothered by something. He said that, I notice people are accustomed to, you know, always as they walk through, touching the mezuzah. Right, we saw with the Rambam that we opened with said, when you pass by a mezuzah, it's as though you're bumping into Hashem, and therefore you should think about, you know, you should awake from your slumber. Okay, which is a great thing to, you know, to try to perhaps imagine, think about Hashem. I teach a program, you know, we just came back from Eretz Yisrael for July, and we have a program of beginners, people who are just became religious, not yet religious, maybe becoming religious, hopefully. So one of the things that we speak about is the idea of making brachas. What's the idea of making a bracha? It's that you're doing your thing. You're doing your thing, you're going to work, you're going to school, whatever you're doing, and all of a sudden you punctuate your day 100 times, 50, 60, 80, 100 times a day. You think about Hashem. Well, I'm going to school, I'm in the cafeteria, in between a final and a lab, and I think about HaKadosh Baruch Hu, just the idea of a bracha. You know, people who grow up religious might not appreciate that, but for somebody who's coming from a secular world, and okay, you know, Saturday mornings, that's for God, Yom Kippur, Rosh Hashanah, that's for God, I come to Jerusalem during July, that's for God, but then I have my life. But the idea of having, you know, every moment of the day punctuated here again and again and again with thinking about Hashem is a powerful idea. So that same idea the Rambam told us by mezuzah. Whenever we eat or come out of the bathroom or do a mitzvah, whenever we walk in and out of any room, we're thinking about Hashem. But the Rambam only said when you walk through a door. He didn't say you put your hand on the mezuzah. Where does that come from? So Rabbi Kveger says he's very bothered by this minhag. Why? Because oftentimes the mezuzahs aren't covered. I guess nowadays, I think most of us do have covered mezuzah in mezuzah cases. But in the time of Rabbi Kveger, he said many times the mezuzah are just, you know, the parchment is there, stuck to the wall, however they stick it, or maybe it's sort of plastered over partially, and people would put their hands directly on the mezuzah. Rabbi Akiva Eger says that the halacha is you're not allowed to directly put your hands in contact with, for example, a Sefer Torah. Sometimes the person does hagba, he does it a little bit not well, or his hands are too loose, and the klaf sort of sags. If you ever notice, they never lift up the klaf with their fingers. Somebody will try to take their talis, and so with their talis, or some cloth, they'll lift up the klaf so it doesn't sag as they're rolling up the Sefer Torah. Because you're not allowed to touch Divrei Kedusha, Sparim, the klaf of a Sefer Torah, or and a mezuzah equally with your hands. And therefore, Rabbi Kveger says it's not proper for people to put their hands on uncovered mezuzahs. So what's the source? So we don't have this issue much because we all typically, first of all, we wrap it in plastic wrap, saran wrap, like you use in your kitchen, that protects it from the moisture. But they didn't have plastic wrap 200 years ago. And anyway, we put it also in lucite or other containers. Where does this idea come from to touch the mezuzah? So it comes from the following story. A story that you might be familiar with, but you might not have realized that this story that you might have heard is the source for that which we actually touched on. So this is a story, Gemara in Avodah Zarah tells a story about Unkelus. Unkelus was a ger. We know he was a ger, he was a great ger, and actually just spoke in shul this week about gerim changing their names. It's interesting that Unkelus, when he was Megai, Avram Avinu, Avram changed to Avraham. Sarai changed to Sarah. Many others that changed their name as they became Yeser came Yisro when he was Megayer. Many people in Tanakh, when they were Megayer, there were other characters in Tanakh, when they were Megayer, they changed their name. Unkelus is one person that didn't change his name. Unkelus is not a Jewish name. Unkelus is a Greek name. So Unkelus the Ger was a nephew, I think, of the Caesar. And when the Caesar heard that his nephew had converted, then he sent a group of Roman soldiers, a battalion, to take him back to Rome to do whatever they needed to do with him. And so, again, if you heard the story, that's great, but the punchline, you'll see how it comes, halacha l'maisa. So they come and he engages them in conversation, and they are so taken with what Judaism has to offer, they are Megayer and don't make their way back to the Caesar. And the Caesar is furious, so he sends another battalion, and he warns them, I want to make sure that you don't engage him in conversation, because he knew what happened to the first battalion. So they grab him, and they don't talk to him, they don't ask him any questions, and he just asks them, can I ask you a question? They don't say anything. They say, if a sergeant, I'm sorry, a private, holds the torch. You know, when the sergeant is walking, he wants to see where he's walking. So he has one of the low the plebeians, the privates, carry a torch to see where he's walking. And the sergeant has to do that for the captain. And the captain has to do it for the major. And the major has to do it for the general. And the general has to hold the torch for the king. Who does the king hold the torch for? And taken by curiosity, they say, nobody, of course. And the king's not going to hold the torch for... You know, and he's on top. He's not going to hold the torch for anybody. And Unkelus responds to them, well, you don't. That's their whole idea. You're missing the most fundamental idea about Judaism. You look in the Torah, and the Torah says that who illuminated when we were traveling through the Midbar and it was dark at night? Who illuminated for us? HaKadosh Baruch Hu had Amud Anan and Amud Eish, Laila La'ir Lahem, to illuminate for us. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the king himself, is taking out the torch to illuminate for the private, for the simple Jew. And they were taken by that idea, and they were Megayah. And at this point, the emperor is furious, and he sends again the last battalion, and they say again they can't say anything, they can't talk, they can't listen. You know, they stuff up their ears with cotton before they go in, and they go in, they just grab him, and they go out. And as he's going out, he puts his hand on the mezuzah, and they don't say anything because again, there's the rules were they don't say a word. And he says, "What am I doing?" And they shrug. And he says, how's the way of the world? The way of the world is that you're working for the king, right? The king has his castle set up. He sits inside. And his security guards, his bodyguards, his protective people, the army, stays outside his palace to protect him. By us, it's just the opposite. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is standing right outside our door to protect us on the inside, and of course they are Megayer as well, and the Caesar gives up, never hoping again to get his nephew back. What did Unkelus do? He He put his hand on the door. That's the source. That's the source. This story that's recorded from the time of Onkelos is the source that it records in the Shulchan Aruch that we have the custom, it doesn't say to kiss necessarily, but we have the custom to put our hands on the mezuzah, which is recorded in the Shulchan Aruch, that when a person goes in or out of their home to touch the mezuzah, and the Gemara, the Shulchan Aruch actually says that a person should say when they go in or out and touch the mezuzah, Hashem Yishmar, instead of the pasuk says, say Tzcha Uvalecha, your comings and goings, Me'atah, from now, forever, Ad Olam. The person should say, the Shulchan Aruch says, in first person, Hashem Yishmar, Hashem should protect, say Si Uvoi, my coming and my going, forever. You know where that pasuk is from? That was the pasuk that Onkelos, in the story that I just told you, when he was telling the guards about how different it is that Hashem is different from a Melech Basar Vadam, that a Melech Basar Vadam, a king of flesh and blood, is protected by his soldiers. And here Hashem protects us. And he says, and where do we see in the Torah that Hashem protects the Jewish people? He quotes this exact pasuk. The pasuk says, Hashem Yishmor Tzeischavach, Hashem will protect your comings and goings forever. That was the pasuk that we see in the story with Onkelos, and that's actually the pasuk that makes its way into the Shulchan Aruch, that we, when we pass by a mezuzah, are, I have seen very few people actually say that pasuk consistently, but it's a nice thing. You do? Okay, great. You're the Revitin's daughter. You're Rabbi Revitin's daughter. That's how it is. My kids don't. Hashem, yeah, to say, Hashem Yishmor Tzeisivoi, Hashem should protect my comings and goings. So I just want to finish with one. That's another thing a person could say. This is a person that's cited in the Shulchan Aruch. But yeah, that's also fine. I want to finish with something that I noticed. I think it's a beautiful idea. But you could take it or leave it, because it's maybe true, maybe it's not. I started this year mentioning that this is the perfect week, because it's right between last week's parasha and this coming week's parasha, the two mentions of mezuzah in the Torah. If we look not just at the pasuk, you're familiar with the pasuk because it's in Shema. We know Chasavta Mamazdos Pesach Avishachu. But if we look at the context of where that pasuk is, again, we know the beginning of the parasha. But what comes right after it? Two different things come right after it in the two parashas, in last week's parasha and this coming week's parasha. And I think it might leave us with two lessons about the point of the mezuzah that we sort of mentioned. We might not have highlighted the two different points, but two different ideas will come out of it. In last week's parasha, you have the first paragraph of Shema, Vahavta, which concludes with Savta Amaz Zos Besecha Visharecha. Right after that, the Torah talks says the following: you'll come to the land that I swore to Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and you'll come to this great big cities that are filled with wealth that you didn't earn, and there will be water systems that you didn't dig, and there will be krumim, orchards, and all kinds of wonderful fields that you didn't plant, v'achalta v'savata, and you're going to be so happy and satiated. But you should remember, it wasn't you who did it. Remember, there's Hashem who gave all these gifts to you. Keep that in mind. That's this past week's parasha. Now let me tell you this coming week's parasha, Parashas Ekev. Before I do that, I will ask a question. Are women obligated in the mitzvah of mezuzah? Does a woman have to have a mezuzah in her house?
Why not?
Of course, yes. The answer is yes. Correct. So you're saying that it's not a mitzvah as man grama, therefore it's not in their category. The Gemara says another reason, though. The Gemara says, even if we wouldn't have that reason, you know what the Torah says? The next words are L'ma'an Yirbu Yameichem, so that your days should be elongated. The Gemara says men's days need to be elongated and women's days don't need to be elongated. Of course, women's days also need to be elongated. So therefore, the bracha that mezuzah brings of elongated a person's days and that bracha that it carries applies equally to men and to women, and therefore women also are obligated mezuzah, even without the idea of it whether or not it's mitzvah seishas man krama. That's what the Torah says. And then it continues, right after it says that, right, you put a mezuzah up on your doorpost, you'll have long days in Eretz Yisrael, and the pasuk continues and says, and you're going to go to, if you do the mitzvos, Hashem will throw out all the nations who are standing against you, and all the nations that you're going to have to fight, Hashem will destroy, and all the land that you, the area that you'll walk with your feet around Eretz Yisrael, you will conquer. Lo yisyatzev ish b'fnech, nobody will stand up against you. Pachtechem u'marachem, your fear, Hashem will place on all the people of the dwellers of the land, and you'll take over Eretz Yisrael. Do you notice that that's a very different message on the heels of Mezuzah than the last week's parsha? Last week's parsha said, do Mezuzah so that when you come to Eretz Yisrael and you see all the wealth, don't think it's you. Be humble. Realize it's HaKadosh Baruch Hu who gives it to you. And this coming week's parasha, it's a very different message. Put a mezuzah so that you will have long life and so that Hashem will throw out all the nations from in front of you and so that Hashem will take care of you. I think there are two very different lessons of mezuzah. And both of them are topics that we mentioned today. The first one is that mezuzah is supposed to humble us. Supposed to be that wake-up call. You go into Eretz, like the Pasuk says, last week's parasha, you go into Eretz, you put the mezuzah on your house, and then when you go into Eretz Yisrael and seal everything that Hashem gave you, realize it's from Him. Realize it's not you. Realize that everything is from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You come into the mezuzah, and you realize things, I'm not the one who makes everything happen, it's not me, I realize that, I pause for a minute, I have that wake-up call, like the Rambam said, and I'm awakened from my slumber of, I realize that there's HaKadosh Baruch Hu who runs the world. That's half of the mezuzah. Mezuzah is to remind us, to awaken us. But then there's a second aspect of mezuzah. The second aspect is from this coming week's parasha, that when we, after again doing the mezuzah, person gets a long life, Hashem will chase away our enemies. Mezuzah is the shmirah. Hashem is taking care of us. So I think mezuzah really has these two ideas that are happening simultaneously. On one hand, mezuzah is for me to realize, to humble me and to realize that I have to wake up and to rededicate myself. At the same time, mezuzah has that capacity to make us realize and for Hashem to provide, to take care of us, to take care of all of our needs and to provide for us and to instill our fear on the other people of the world. That's also a message that the mezuzah has, which is two separate messages. And that's actually the Baal HaTurim is the one who makes this point on the this coming week's parasha. He says, what's the purpose of mezuzah? Right after that, we have the words, L'man yirbu yimeichem, so that as a person does the mezuzah, he should realize, she should realize, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu brings bracha and protection through the mezuzah. So hopefully, next time we pass the mezuzah, we should have both of these points in our mind. And maybe, this I don't know. Maybe when you go in to your house, you realize that all the bracha that I have in my house, it's not me. Not that I made the $1 million. It's not that I made the great decisions. When I go into my house, I realize it's all from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. When I go out of my house, I realize I'm going to a place, all kinds of dangers out there, lurking out there. There are bears and bulls and all kinds of type. What's the... Bears and something, oh my.
Lions and tigers.
Lions and tigers and bears, oh my, right? And I realize that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is protecting me as I go outside, so hopefully we should always have both of these ideas in mind. The humility on one hand, and on the other hand, the fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu takes care of us, and hopefully with that, HaKadosh Baruch Hu indeed give us humility and indeed take wonderful care of us. Thank you all for coming. And Ve'ez Hashem, next week we're going to be talking about next week's topic. It's on the schedule, so see. I think so, yeah. Well, we don't see in the Shulchan Aruch that you have to kiss it, but that touching it, I think, either in or out.